This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry today, and thank you so much for listening. Justice appears to be moving swiftly in Cincinnati, Ohio. On Wednesday, a Hamilton County grand jury indicted University of Cincinnati police officer Ray Tensing in the death of 43-year-old Sam DeBose. Tensing shot and killed DeBose during a traffic stop on July 19th after DeBose was pulled over for failure to properly display a license plate on the front of his car. It's the first time a Cincinnati police officer has ever been charged in connection with the use of force, let alone murder.
Where do you say that? Down here?
Right around the corner.
Okay. Well, until I can figure out if you have a license or not, go ahead and take your seatbelt off for me.
I didn't even do nothing.
Go ahead and take your seatbelt off. Stop!
That sound of the altercation captured from the body camera worn by Officer Tensing, and you heard the gunshot there. Hamilton County Prosecutor Joe Dieter said in a news conference yesterday that after reviewing that footage, this was without question a murder.
I think he lost his temper. And when you see this, you will not believe how quickly he pulls his gun and shoots him in the head. It's maybe a second.
Lost temper and a life lost in yet another deeply troubling instance of police violence against African Americans this year. Now, Tensing, who is white, claimed he had been dragged by the vehicle and had to fire his weapon to protect himself, and other officers helped back up that claim. But Prosecutor Dieters dismissed those claims on Wednesday. He said that Tensing only fell backwards after firing that deadly shot. Sam DeBose's sister, Tarina, spoke to reporters yesterday.
If it were not for that video camera, Sam would be no different than all the other incidents because the second officer was ready to corroborate every lie that the first officer said in the report. So I just want to be very clear that we feel for a lot of families out there. That man shot my brother dead. This would be the same if it were not for that video camera.
Cincinnati, meanwhile, is a city that has enjoyed a reputation as a leader in police reforms before this week. For more, we're joined by Wendell Young now. He's a Cincinnati City Council member. Councilman Young also retired from the Cincinnati Police Department with rank of sergeant after 25 years of service. Wendell Young, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And welcome back to the show. You know, Councilman Young, we've had you on before to talk about the successes in police relations in Cincinnati. And this terrible incident certainly pushes in the other direction.
It does. But I do want to clear up one thing. I heard someone say that this was a Cincinnati police officer. He's actually a University of Cincinnati police officer, not a city police officer.
Right. And we're going to get to that very issue.
Okay.
Well, we'll go ahead because he is a University of Cincinnati police officer. But again, more broadly, you come from a city where at least relations between, you know, sworn officers with badges, to say the least, and the public have improved. And Cincinnati has been a model.
Cincinnati has been a model and hopefully will continue to be one. We didn't get to this place easily, and I don't want to paint the picture that we have a police-community relations utopia in Cincinnati. We still have some issues, but we're a far better police department and a far better city than we used to be. And this particular incident, in my opinion, at least to date, sort of shows just how far we've come. If this had happened several years ago, I shudder to think what the public outcry would have been and what perhaps other things may have occurred. But today, what we've seen are peaceful demonstrations, people calling for justice. I think people applauding the prosecutor, who many of us have issues with, but applauding him this time for doing what we believe is the right thing. I think in addition to that, we enjoy a police chief in Cincinnati, a man named Jeffrey Blackwell, who is extremely visible in the community. He's out and about almost every day. He's everywhere all the time. And I think that the things he does make him a good ambassador and by extension builds a lot of goodwill for the officers in the Cincinnati Police Department. But we do enjoy a good reputation here, but it's something we work at every day. It's something we pray about every night.
Now, you drew the line, and we're going to draw it, too, between the Cincinnati Police Department and the University of Cincinnati Police. At the same time, those university police carry guns, they have badges, and they're sworn officers. So they're clearly cops. There have been calls in your city to disband that system and have your old department patrol the university. Other universities do this too. It's not unique to Cincinnati. Why does that matter? Is effectively a university cop the same in terms of his training, his or her training, and what a city cop would be, or should they be?
I can't speak to the exact amount of training that University of Cincinnati police officers get. What I will tell you is that the Ohio Police Officer Training Academy, which we call OPATA here in Ohio, is responsible for the commissioning of all police officers. The University of Cincinnati police officers are commissioned by OPATA. So they are, by definition, police officers in every sense of the word. What a lot of people don't know is that they have authority off the campus. And I think that adds to some confusion. Joe Dieters, our prosecutor, put forth yesterday the notion that perhaps the University of Cincinnati Police Department should be disbanded and the Cincinnati Police Department should take over those duties of patrolling the campus. I'm not sure that I think that's a good idea. I think it's pretty much a knee-jerk reaction, but it feels like kind of throwing out the baby with the bathwater. I think the more responsible thing to do is to really do a top-to-bottom review of what the University of Cincinnati Police Department looks like in terms of its training, its professionalism, and so forth, and determine whether that department can be maintained and simply improved, even with greater cooperation from the Cincinnati Police Department. But Santa Ono, the president of the University of Cincinnati, said yesterday, and I agree, policing in an urban environment and policing on a university campus are different. Before I became a Cincinnati police officer, I was a police officer in the United States Air Force, and policing there was different than what I found when I became a Cincinnati police officer. And so different things need to occur, different mindsets need to happen. So I believe that it's better to just increase the cooperation between the two, buttress the University of Cincinnati as best we can, do the top-down review. We also have a collaborative agreement here in Cincinnati that the University of Cincinnati has agreed to incorporate into the way it does things. And one of the things that would offer is that in Cincinnati, when we have a major incident like that, within 24 hours, we're releasing as much information as possible. The university had to wait 48 hours before they would release anything. And we have learned over the years that the longer you wait to tell the public what's going on, the more damage you do to your relationship. Mm-hmm. So there are some things I think that the University of Cincinnati can learn from the Cincinnati experience. But I'm not certain that disbanding the University of Cincinnati Police Department is the way to go.
And at the same time, it's clear that the one part of the national debate which has transcended a lot of these different incidents, body cameras, has made an enormous difference there on the campus and in the city of Cincinnati. Ray Tensing has been charged with murder. Wendell Young is a Cincinnati city councilman and a 25-year veteran of the Cincinnati Police Department. Thanks again, Councilman.
Thank you.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. Todd Zwillick with you today. It was the bow and arrow shot heard around the world, fired by Dr. Walter Palmer, a dentist from Minnesota, which maimed and eventually killed the most famous lion in all of Zimbabwe. The lion, of course, was Cecil. He was a major tourist draw, the king of his pride, and the subject of a long-term study by researchers at Oxford University. Now, an avid trophy hunter, Palmer paid $50,000 to his two guides, who lured Cecil from the sanctuary where he was protected, and after helping to kill him, tried to destroy his GPS collar. Dr. Palmer claims that he had no idea that killing Cecil was illegal, and in a statement he said, quote, "I relied on the expertise of my local professional guides to ensure a legal hunt." Meanwhile, back in the United States, one tabloid in New York has branded Palmer with the headline, "America's Most Hated." I saw that this morning. Now, the legality of that hunt is currently being investigated in Zimbabwe, but the investigation is doing nothing to stem the tide of public outrage, which I just mentioned, with many critics, including late-night host Jimmy Kimmel, asking this.
Let's say we accept at face value that he thought it was legal and properly handled and didn't know the lion had a tracking collar. It was a local affair. The big question is, why are you shooting a lion in the first place? I mean, I'm honestly curious to know why a human being would feel compelled to do that. How is that fun?
Dr. Jason G. Goldman is a cognitive scientist, animal behavior researcher, a science writer who's come to terms with the fact that many people around the world do enjoy hunting big game for sport, both endangered species and non-endangered. And he says that focusing our outrage at trophy hunters might be misguided. Now, Goldman lays out many of his arguments in an article called "Can Trophy Hunting Actually Help Conservation?" It's a piece he wrote for Conservation Magazine. Dr. Goldman, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
You're writing this article, or this article is coming out. You're getting attention at a time where you want us to understand the motivation and psychology of trophy hunters like Dr. Palmer. And I think for a lot of people, including Jimmy Kimmel and a lot of the rest of us, it's a big ask.
Yeah, well, I should say that I personally don't quite understand what's fun about this. But from a conservation perspective, from a wildlife management perspective, there are some arguments to be made about the viability of hunting, of legal hunting, at least, as a sort of viable management strategy.
And now you've written about the big money that can come in via auctions for game hunting licenses in places like Zimbabwe, South Africa. They can get, in some cases, I read about a license to hunt a black rhino that was $350,000. Again, it kind of makes you cringe, somebody wanting to pay that much to shoot a black rhino. But you say that this kind of money and proper management can sink money back into conservation and can actually help. Explain your argument a little bit.
Well, at least that's the idea. The argument that gets put forward in these sorts of circumstances is that amount of money, the $50,000 that went for the killing of this lion, the $350,000 that went at auction for the black rhino last year, that's a lot of money. For sure. And it's a lot more money from a single individual than your sort of average, tourist would spend, going on safari in Africa, going to take a bunch of photos. And at least in principle, and there's some scientific data to support this, those hunters would be spending that money in places that aren't otherwise generating revenue from ecotourism, either because the landscapes are simply not pretty enough to attract tourists, or because there are parts of the continent that are a little bit more unstable, or they're more remote. And in principle, at least, a significant chunk of that money is supposed to be funneled back into local communities and back into conservation efforts on the ground. I think it's reasonable to ask how often in some places this happens in practice, but at least in theory, that's the idea.
Now, also in practice, you have argued that the real threat, the direct threat, of course, there's habitat destruction and everything else, but in terms of the actual killing of endangered species, the real threat comes from illegal poaching for rhino horns and lots of other illegal activities, and not from big game hunters, even if they're skirting rules the way Palmer or his guides did.
Yeah, I think it's at least worth noting a distinction between issues of animal welfare, which apply to individual animals, and issues of conservation and wildlife management, which apply to groups of animals, to populations. Certainly, if you're someone who thinks that there is never an acceptable occasion in which it's okay to hunt an animal, those arguments usually come from an animal welfare perspective. But if you're sort of willing to accept the possibility that in some cases, in some circumstances, in some places for some species, hunting can be a useful strategy, then it's worth thinking about the differences in scale between a handful of animals that are legally killed every year, for trophies, and the thousands of animals, tens of thousands in some cases, that are killed illegally through poaching and other means.
And before we let you go, Dr. Goldman, you've also argued pretty interestingly that if there is going to be big game hunting like this, and the money, sometimes the big money, can benefit conservation, management efforts like limiting hunting to non-breeding males that don't affect the population because they don't breed anymore, that kind of thing can help.
Yeah, again, that's at least the way it's supposed to work. Typically, when these auctions are sold, when these licenses are sold at auction, they're they're not sort of blanket licenses to shoot the first animal that you see. They're designated for a specific individual. And often it's an older male who's already contributed genetically to a social group. So there is at least a method to the way that these herds are managed, if they're managed for hunting.
Dr. Jason G. Goldman is a cognitive scientist. He's a animal behavioral researcher. He wrote, "Can trophy hunting actually help conservation?" in Conservation Magazine. Dr. Goldman, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Well, the killing of Cecil has caused an uproar on social media, that's for sure. Here's Guy Gold on the Takeaway Facebook page. "In a world where 80% of the population lives on less than $10 a day, this is a prime example of the ugly American. This well-to-do, college-educated dentist felt the best use of his $50,000 was to fly across the world to poach a lion." Keep the conversation going. Call us at 8778-MYTAKE. You can comment at thetakeaway.org or on facebook.com/thetakeaway. Well, more than a year after Malaysian Airlines flight MH370 disappeared en route from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing, French and American officials believe that a piece of the plane may have been found. What appears to be a wing flap washed up on the shore of the French island of Réunion in the Indian Ocean on Wednesday. French experts will now work quickly to confirm if it is indeed a piece of that Malaysian Airlines jet. Joining me now with more is Barbara Peterson. She's aviation correspondent for Condé Nast Traveler and Popular Mechanics. Barbara, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Oh, great to be here.
So what do we know so far about this wing flap that's been discovered?
Well, it appears to be a part of a 777, a Boeing 777, which is the type of plane, of course, that was involved with the MH370 disappearance. And if that is the case, then there's really only one plane it can be, which, of course, is the missing aircraft, because, 777s don't just disappear every day. So really, by process of elimination, it has to be that Malaysia Airlines plane.
So that means that sort of affirmatively, the investigators don't have to show that this piece is from that jet. They can deduce that it is because no other 777s are missing.
Well, they will do all of that, though. They will have to look at the serial number that they will find when they really examine it closely. They can match it to that exact model. So, yes, they will be able to, do that kind of verification very fast. In fact, we're told that it could be as early as 24 hours from now.
And even if that confirmation comes, Barbara Peterson, it's only one small piece of it. The rest of the plane, the fuselage, still remains a mystery.
Precisely. And that is really going to be the big question going forward. Does the discovery of this piece of wreckage, basically almost 3,000 miles from where the current search is underway, does that help them find the rest of the plane? It's crucial now that they find it, because so many questions are unanswered. And this is only a tiny piece of the puzzle. But I have to say, it does solve one of the more enduring mysteries, which was why, after it's been 500 days, after all, has not a single piece of floating debris surfaced. That was the thing that really troubled aviation experts, because, frankly, that is unprecedented in the history of modern aircraft crashes. So the fact that this looks like it is from the plane is an extraordinary breakthrough, because in the absence of that, all sorts of other theories were flourishing. And while a lot of them were quite far-fetched, you couldn't debunk them without this type of evidence.
So the conspiracy theories, many of them go away if this is indeed a piece of MH370. But the most important part of this, of course, is closure for grieving families who've never been able to bury their lost loved ones, who've had to endure the worldwide media crush. And if this is a piece of a plane, I guess there's some closure, but not too much without the rest of it, Barbara Peterson.
Exactly. And it's a bittersweet moment, because it, as you say, it is, for some people, finally giving them that evidence that the plane did go down and no one possibly could have survived it. And I think what it will do, though, is rejuvenate the search for the wreckage. And this doesn't mean that they're not looking in the right place. In fact, with the ocean drift modeling that they've done, this actually confirms that they were probably on the right track.
Barbara Peterson, thank you.
Thank you.
Barbara Peterson is aviation correspondent for Condé Nast Traveler and Popular Mechanics.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity, introducing a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program, performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
You know, America's ambassadors and senators and presidents have been spending a lot of time lately worrying about hostilities and maybe even future hostilities with Iran, and rightfully so. But it might be time to start worrying about our so-called friendly neighbors to the north. Tensions have been rising between American and Canadian lobstermen over the fishing rights on the waters off of three islands off the coast of Maine, or depending on who you ask, off the coast of Nova Scotia. And the problem is as old as the United States itself, and a lot older than Canada, for what it's worth, 232 years old, to be exact. It's a bona fide land dispute along an otherwise peaceful border more than 5,000 miles long. Stephen Kelly is a public policy professor at Duke University who studies border disputes. He's also a former American diplomat to Canada, and he vacations in Maine right near Machias Seal Island. That's the biggest of the three disputed islands. They don't have much more than a Canadian lighthouse on that island built back in 1832. But the area is increasingly popular for lobstermen on both sides of the border.
This year, actually, the lobster crop is down, and the price of lobster has gone up. And the word is out that there's a lot of lobster around Machias Seal Island. So Canadian lobstermen from as far away as Nova Scotia are coming into waters that are disputed. So if you don't know who owns Machias Seal Island, you draw a circle around it, and the fishery around it is really what's in contention here.
Yeah, I was going to ask if the puffin watchers on both sides of the border have come to a head and are threatening violence, but I guess it is the lobstermen who you worry about having a confrontation. Have there been any this summer?
The lobstermen that I've talked to say that some of the press reports on this, there was a report out of one of the Canadian news magazines that suggested that war was imminent. It's not that bad, but there is definitely a feeling that there's a new element in the fishery this summer.
What are the locals saying? Are they gearing up for conflict? Are they firing off letters to the White House to demand action from their government? Are they mobilizing the flotillas? What's going on?
For the fishermen in Cutler, this is really important. More than 50% of their fishing area is in this so-called gray zone. So they're concerned about it, but there's actually kind of a feeling of pessimism. I didn't take a poll, but the couple of people that I've talked to in Cutler worry that almost any resolution of this problem is going to be bad for them. But the conclusion I've reached from this summer, and I've been looking at this issue for 3 years, is that the status quo is probably not going to work anymore. Border problems don't fade away. They fester. And then something happens, and suddenly you get nationalists on both sides of the border yelling and screaming. And unfortunately, when the politicians get into issues, they often become harder to resolve.
Indeed. I mean, we only have to look at the dispute going on between China and Japan over a couple of islands. I don't want to overblow this situation to suggest it's a confrontation like that, but those things can get out of hand and quickly.
Indeed, and those rocks in the East China Sea that they're fighting over are also treeless, unpopulated. There are actually two people who live on Machias Seal Island. They're Canadian lighthouse keepers. And when I was out there in June, I actually met with them. They go out for 28-day shifts. But the lighthouse is totally automatic. They do absolutely nothing except for mow the lawn. They are there strictly to maintain Canada's sovereignty claim. And in fact, there's a guy here in Jonesport, Barna Norton, who passed away in 2004. He also claimed that Machias Seal Island was his, that he had inherited it from his great-grandfather. And I actually visited his grave here in Jonesport a couple of weeks ago. And there's a bronze plaque over his tombstone that says, Barna, defender of Machias Seal Island. So he took his ownership claim quite seriously. He'd lead a group of Americans out there every 4th of July with American flags that they would plant on the island.
Well, it makes me wonder, Professor Kelly, if the State Department or the state of Maine or Secretary Kerry himself are going to take this issue seriously and head off the dispute before it gets out of hand? I mean, what's the solution here?
The U.S. and Canada share a 5,525-mile border, the longest in the world. With our history of friendship, and Canada's our largest trading partner, our largest oil supplier, that border is really important to both countries. And if we can't work out a problem like this, then how do you expect China and Japan to work out theirs, or China and India? There's border disputes all over the world, and we ought to be a model for the peaceful and logical resolution of an issue like this.
Duke Public Policy Professor Stephen Kelly there. So is the Secretary of State taking a break from selling the Iran nuclear deal to negotiate with the Canadians over Machias Seal Island? Not exactly. But I did get the chance to ask Senator Susan Collins and Angus King, both of Maine, for their thoughts on this issue. They both knew exactly what I was talking about. Collins says that the dispute won't change the loving relationship between Maine and Canada.
In Maine, we have such close ties to Canada. And there are so many families, including my own, that are intermingled. So I don't see this as creating a huge rift between the two countries.
Senator Angus King, for his part, he wasn't so sure.
Robert Frost's old saying was, good fences make good neighbors. And if there isn't a fence and there's a lack of clarity, then it could lead to confrontation, which would serve no one's interest. I know that it is rising to the level of national attention or federal attention, and I certainly intend to try to push that process along.
And we'll be following along, too. So I went to see the new Amy Winehouse documentary the other night. It's called simply Amy. And the opening scene of the movie is a home movie. It's Amy and her friends celebrating somebody's birthday, and she's about 14 years old. Listen.
It's my 14th birthday evening and party.
Yes,
happy birthday to you. Happy birthday.
Ah, that voice, right? 14. And then at the end of the film as the credits roll, you can guess there's a ton of music for all the different songs in the movie. There's Rehab, there's Back to Black, there's dozens. But first, before all of them, credits and a copyright for what you just heard there. Credits for Happy Birthday to You. And that means that the film's producers had to pay somebody probably a lot of money to play that clip of Amy Winehouse singing to a friend when she was a kid. And that's true. And it's because the song is owned by a company called Warner Chappell Music, and they charge a lot of money for its public use. And sometimes it puts Hollywood writers in a tough position where they have to come up with creative alternatives to save some money.
We baked you a birthday cake if you get to me, and you moan and groan and woe. Don't forget, we told you so.
What day is today? It's Nibbler's birthday.
Happy birthday, happy birthday, dear friend. We sing to you.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to me. Now we all get to sing. Happy birthday for free.
There's your medley of birthday songs from the Three Stooges, from Futurama, even Mr. Rogers, Stephen Colbert at the end, all specially designed, of course, to not have to pay anyone for singing happy birthday during a performance. But we might soon hear more of the real birthday song. Here's why. 2 years ago, a filmmaker named Jennifer Nelson filed a lawsuit against Warner Chappell about this copyright claim. And new evidence in the case suggests that she might be close to winning it. Mark Rifkin is her lawyer. He's lead counsel for the plaintiff. And he joins me now. Hi, Mark. Welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi, Todd. It's great to be here.
And it's great to have you. So I played Amy Winehouse at the top there. How much did the producers of that film probably have to pay Warner Chappell to play that clip of Amy Winehouse when she was 14?
Just a guess on my part, but I would assume it's somewhere in the neighborhood of $5,000 to $10,000, maybe more. We know that that our clients in the case paid between $1,500 and $3,000 for use of the song in much smaller settings. And we also know that in large theatrical productions, Warner Chappell sometimes charges $100,000 or more to use the song.
So it's not a jingle writer or a composer in some dusty office near Broadway who wrote a ditty and got rich off of it. I mean, this is a big corporation. How did we get here to the point where Warner Chappell Music is charging either $1,500 or $5,000 or $100,000 for this song that we all sing over birthday cakes, you know, all the time?
That's a great question. Warner bought a company called Birch Tree Group Limited in 1988. Birch Tree Group claimed to own the copyright since 1935, and they claimed to have gotten it from two sisters who wrote a song called Good Morning to All, which has the same melody as Happy Birthday, but different words. And then in 1935, that company copyrighted some piano arrangements for that melody. And one of those piano arrangements included the Happy Birthday lyrics, which had for decades before then been in the public domain. But because of that copyright, Warner Chappell now says it owns the song.
Now, it's your argument that it was in the public domain long before that, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But, you know, on the other hand, Mark Rifkin, you know, this goes back to maybe composers have to get paid for their work. They deserve to get paid for their work. And just because a song is ubiquitous in the culture and we think we all own it doesn't mean we do.
No doubt. And I am a firm believer in the importance of copyright and a very strong supporter of the arts, which means that people who want to do something creative need to be allowed to do it and need to be compensated for it. But an artist also has the right to say his creative work belongs to the public. When Patty Hill, one of the sisters who wrote the original song, changed the words later, she decided that the public should have it because it was such an amusing little song. She was already being compensated for the song she wrote with her sister, Good Morning to All. And so this variation she gave to the public. And she said that several times. She never tried to protect her rights to Happy Birthday, although several times she tried to protect her rights to Good Morning to All. And so I think the evidence is clear here that she intended for this song, Happy Birthday, to belong to the public. And one thing you need to know, her original copyright for Good Morning to All expired in 1949. So that copyright has already come and gone. So all that's left are these lyrics, which were included in a piano arrangement that was written by somebody else, not Patti Smith Hill, and it had nothing to do with Happy Birthday to You.
And that's part of the new evidence that I mentioned just before, the new evidence that you've said means that this case should be decided in your favor. I guess a new piece of sheet music from 1922. Do I have it right?
Correct. We found a piece of sheet music that was authorized to be published in 1922, including both songs, Good Morning to All and Happy Birthday to You, without a copyright notice. And under the law as it existed in 1922, that publication has a consequence. It forfeits the copyright protection. And so by 1922, there's no question that Happy Birthday was in the public domain.
Your client is Jennifer Nelson. She's a filmmaker herself, in fact, making a film about the fact that this song is copyrighted. If she wins here, what does the victory mean for her?
Well, the victory means for her that she gets back the fee that she paid. But more importantly, the victory for her means that she will have been part of an effort to make the song public again, to give the song back to the public, to honor Patty Hill's wish that it be common property of the nation.
Mark Rifkin is lead counsel for the plaintiffs in the case to make Happy Birthday to You part of the public domain. He would say part of the public domain again. Mark Rifkin, I know you see this coming. You want to sing me a ditty of Good Morning to All? I know you do it around your office.
Good morning to you. Good morning to you. Good morning, dear children. Good morning to all. I'm no Amy Winehouse.
Yeah, no Amy Winehouse for sure, Mark Rifkin. Can we hear her one more time?
Happy birthday to you.
And here's a final thought to take with you today. Another executive order from the president calling for the United States to build the world's fastest computer by 2025. President Obama wants the computer to be 20 times quicker than the current leading machine. which resides in China. Now, according to the White House, it would be capable of making 1 quintillion calculations per second. That's a billion billion. And some observers have pointed out that this order comes at a time when 37 million Americans don't even have regular internet access. And that's true. But still, more of us might be looking at the world's fastest machine and wonder, is the executive order the presidential signature that seals our fate?
Skynet begins to learn at a geometric rate.
Has the commander-in-chief signed a warrant for self-aware machines? Mr. President, have you seen the Terminator?
It becomes self-aware at 2:14 a.m. Eastern Time.
That's all for today, but we do want to hear from you. Call us at 8778-MY-TAKE, or you can tweet me. I'm at Todd Zwillick. Thank you so much for listening. I am Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry. I'll be back tomorrow. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.